so I framed this talk, and I just spent 10 days in Florida, and once again it proved that that was a critical issue that's in people's minds, especially since the Dover court case did not go so well for the intelligent design crowd. And so this talk is titled More Than Intelligent Design, which is basically what we think it reasons to believe should be the next step and then moving towards intelligent design. Now, what I want to say at the outset is there's many different ways of doing intelligent design, and what's being criticized in the popular press and by the scientific community is what's referred to as the intelligent design movement. For what it's worth, at Reasons to Believe, we were doing intelligent design more than 10 years before the intelligent design movement even got launched. And so recognizing there's many different ways of doing intelligent design, simply because we lost the court case in Dover doesn't mean that the battle or the war is over there. And incidentally, it's similar to what goes on in creation evolution. There's many different ways of doing creation and many different definitions of creation. Likewise, there's many different definitions of evolution. If you go to our website at reasons.org, you'll see a downloadable paper there. It's only one page long, and it's titled The Shell Game of Evolution and Creation. We're tempted to write another one on the shell game of intelligent evolution. And the shell game is played by both sides, where they kind of raise up a straw man definition of, say, creation. They knock that down and claim they've wiped out creation. And likewise, people come up with a straw man of evolution. They knock that down and think they've wiped out evolution. Or what I see being played here in the state of California, they'll say, we have overwhelming proof that evolution is true. But there they're referring to the definition of evolution as the evidence that things change with respect to time. Then they change the definition of evolution and say that change takes place without any supernatural intervention. And they try to claim that they have overwhelming evidence for that. Well, they've got overwhelming evidence for the first definition, but not the second definition. So a lot of what we're going to talk about today is that kind of a shell game. Now, what I want to do first off is review for you the criticisms of the intelligent design movement. Not of intelligent design, but the intelligent design movement. And these are the criticisms that show up in the popular press, popular media. I mean, if you're watching Discovery Channel or PBS on TV, you'll hear this all the time. And it even gets into Fox News and the other major news critiques of intelligent design. It's also the criticisms that you'll see if you read the scientific literature. Virtually all the science journals that try to cover the full spectrum of the scientific disciplines, notably Science and Nature and Scientific American, have come across with these criticisms. And there are basically five criticisms. There's more than these five, but these are the five that come up all the time. They'll make the point that intelligent design is not science and therefore has no role in the science classroom or the education, public education arena. Because number one, intelligent design cannot be tested and it cannot be falsified. Now what they mean by falsified is that you cannot come up with an experiment or an observation that if it went one particular way would definitively prove that there is no intelligent design. So that's what they mean when they say it's not falsifiable. The proponents of the intelligent design movement aren't able to come up with a test that could possibly show that the intelligent design paradigm is incorrect. They'll also make the charge that intelligent design is not observable, it's not repeatable, in the sense that you can't go back and see exactly the creation event. Actually, that's not quite true, but that's a common charge. Number three, they'll say there's no predictions that come out of the intelligent design movement. That's also not totally accurate. However, it's not as predictive as what you see in other scientific disciplines. They'll say there's no refinement. This intelligent design movement has been around for 10 years, but we don't see any changes going on or development or improvement in the description of their paradigm. And probably the biggest complaint of all is that the intelligent design movement tolerates provably false creation models. And particularly what they're referring to here is a young Earth creationism. And probably the most famous phrase with respect to the intelligent design movement, it was crafted by a physics professor at University of Arizona, where he said that intelligent design is creationism in a cheap tuxedo. And the whole point is that the intelligent design movement is seen as a thin veil, as a cover, to bring back creationism into the public school arena. Now, when I use the term creationism, whenever you see that term on television or in the print media, it means young earth creationism. There's this attempt to try to imply that if you believe in creation, you must believe that everything happened in less than 10,000 years. That's not correct. That's part of the shell game. But you need to be aware that when you read that term in the media, creationism, they're referring to the young earth creationist model. And the point that the scientific community is making here is that this has been tried four separate times in the courts. And I'm not referring to the Scopes trial. I'm talking about court cases that have taken place after World War II, for that matter, after 1960. And in all four cases, the courts ruled that the young earth creationist model was not permissible in the public education arena. Why? Because it was a provably false explanation of the record of nature. But that's been the biggest criticism of the intelligent design movement, that they tolerate young earth creationism. And they tolerate it in this sense. About 95% of their sales, by estimates, are purchases by young earth creationist organizations or people holding the young earth model. And there's also been a studious attempt not to deny the young earth creationist model. I've seen this personally myself when intelligent design speakers are on the campus. Someone will ask them a question, what do you believe is the age of the universe or the age of the earth? And they refuse to answer the question. And that's why Adrian Malott, for example, came up with that statement that intelligent design is simply creationism in a cheap tuxedo. What he is looking for, and the rest of the scientific community is looking for, is a clear-cut disavowal of the young earth creationist model. Now, that may be forthcoming, but so far it's not there within the intelligent design movement camp. The other big complaint, and this is universal, and I hear this all the time when I speak on the campus, is that these evolutionists see us Christians as being nothing but negative in our apologetics. And in particular, they brand us as being nothing but evolution bashers. Non-Christian academics view all Christian apologists as simply those who want to attack the evolutionary model. And they see our apologetics as simply that. All we're doing is pointing out flaws in the evolutionary model, and we're not willing, or what they'll actually say is, you don't have the courage of your convictions to come forward with an explanation that you think is better and invite us to attack what you think is a good creation explanation. It is that it's easy to be simply on the offensive attacking somebody else's models. What scientists are looking for is someone will come forward with their own model and invite critique of that. In fact, back in 1998, there was a prime-time television debate between four evolutionists and four intelligent design proponents, all members of the intelligent design movement. It was on PBS, and it was moderated by William F. Buckley, Jr., and it was called Creation on the Firing Line. But what I noticed in that two-hour debate is that every one of the evolutionists fired back at the intelligent design proponents and said, show us your model. In fact, I think I heard that at least nine times in the debate. Where is your model? Show us your model. Don't just critique us. Don't just critique our evolution, but show us what your model is. And the point that they were trying to make repeatedly is all models have flaws. And simply pointing out flaws in a model does not prove that the model is incorrect. What it takes is a model that has greater explanation. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with this term, what is a model? A model offers an explanation for the what, the where, the when, the how, and the cause. Now, what I'm referring to here is a model that tries to explain the record of nature. There are also models that can be used in other disciplines. But with respect to science, a model tries to offer an explanation for what happens, where it happens, when it happens, how it happens, what are the causes behind the phenomena, and most importantly, why does the phenomena appear the way it does? And based on the explanation that it comes up with, it predicts what researchers will discover in their future research. And this is really what's missing in the intelligent design movement. Yes. Yeah, there's a big, yeah. A theory will try to explain one particular phenomena in isolation with the rest of phenomena. And some theories are very well established, some are not. Now, people try to claim that there's this gradation from an hypothesis to a theory. Well, for example, the theory of general relativity is established better than some of our laws of physics, but it's still called a theory. And it's called a theory because it's looking at one particular aspect of the record of nature. A model, on the other hand, tries to explain the entirety of the phenomena, and therefore you're obligated to look at all aspects of the measurements that pertain to what's going on in that phenomena, not just an explanation of a particular theoretical aspect of that phenomena. And so that's what a model is. A model is trying to explain the phenomena relevant to the record of nature you're investigating. And a model is considered good if it offers a better explanation than competing models. It's considered to be good if it is more successful in predicting what scientists will discover in their future research. And what we recognize here, and this is something I've personally been trying to get across to the Christian community for over 20 years, that if you want to convert evolutionists away from their evolutionary models to a Christian perspective, you need to recognize that evolutionists will not abandon their model, no matter how badly flawed that model may be, until they see another model with greater explanatory power and predictive success. And so if you talk to evolutionists, they'll freely admit that there's lots of problems with their Darwinian explanation, for example. And incidentally, the Darwinian explanation is not the only explanation that atheists offer. I could name for you three different models that atheists use to explain the record of life here on planet Earth. So knocking down Darwinism will not win the day. You've got to knock down all the evolutionary models. And why do they have these competing models? Because they recognize that there's serious flaws in the Darwinian model. So pointing out those flaws doesn't do anything. They already recognize that these flaws exist. But their whole point is all models have flaws, and this is the best we see, so we're going to hang on to it until something better comes along. And so the failure of the intelligent design movement to provide that superior explanation is what's preventing intelligent design being recognized as science and having any access in public education. What scientists will tell you is if you don't have a model, you have no place or role at the table of science or at the table of science education. That's why it's so important to base your intelligent design explanation on a model. By the way, Cliff interrupted me. I'm going to invite all of you to interrupt me whenever you want. This is a Sunday school class. It's not a lecture. So if you got questions or comments, feel free to interrupt. And if I don't finish today, I've always got next Sunday, right? And by the way, I'm not going to have to go out of town only once for the rest of the spring and the summer. So, and I may not even miss any Sundays, so we may be in good shape here. Now, when people claim that intelligent design is not science, you hear that charge all the time. It's not true. There are many scientific disciplines that are based on an intelligent design paradigm. And let me give you some examples. One would be archaeology. Archaeology is a successful intelligent design discipline that's acknowledged as such by everyone within the scientific community. And you know how an archaeologist works. He goes to some site that they think is the ruins of some civilization, and they look for artifacts. And when they find those artifacts, they try to determine what intelligent agent was responsible for manufacturing that particular artifact. They'll try to identify, say, what millennium the humans were in coming up with that. Or they might pick up an artifact and say this wasn't made by humans at all. It might have been made by an animal. Or they might pick it up and say this is simply the product of erosion. Now notice what makes this intelligent design discipline successful is that the archaeologist identifies the intelligent designer or a variety of intelligent designers, looks at the evidence to see which intelligent designer is responsible for the artifact that they're observing. Anthropology is another example where they pick up these tools and they try to determine which bipedal primate might be responsible for that tool, or maybe they'll determine it's not intelligently designed at all. Again, it's something that was accidentally formed. You know, sometimes, you know, keep in mind that these Neanderthals, when they made tools, they took a hammer rock and smashed it against a core rock and got flakes that they used for scraping the flesh off bones. Well, occasionally, a hammer rock will fall accidentally off of a mountain and hit a core rock on the bottom and make a bunch of flakes. And so the anthropologist needs to look at those flakes and say, did someone purposely hammer this rock, or was it simply accidental? But again, what makes this whole discipline successful is that the investigator has this variety of intelligent designers, looks at the evidence to see which fits. And one of the things I've found helpful in talking to audiences is the popularity of all these CSI shows that are going on. I mean, I don't know how many they have these days. I've only watched a couple of them, but I'm waiting for CSI Des Moines to get launched. But it's been wonderful, and it shows people how intelligent design science is to be done. Again, the forensic scientist goes to the scene where there's a dead body, and right away comes up with a variety of intelligent causes for the death of that body. One might be that the individual committed suicide, so the body was responsible for the death by design, or it might be a number of different or murder suspects. Or it could be that the body died of natural causes, that there wasn't any intelligent design behind the death at all. And you know how these shows work. They go to the lab, they look at all the evidence, they have all these different suspects, and they try to get sufficient evidence that they can rule out all the intelligent design suspects except one, and they can try an individual for murder. The anthropic principle, this is one arena where intelligent design and identifying the designer as something other than a human being has been noted as the legitimate scientific discipline for the past 40 years. This discipline was launched back in 1961, interestingly, by an atheist, the physicist Robert Dickey at Princeton University. But since that time, there's been a phenomenal number of discoveries indicating that the universe has these characteristics of design. And as I've written in The Creator and the Cosmos, there's now a consensus amongst the astronomers who do research in this discipline that the evidence overwhelmingly points to an intelligent designer. Now, what makes this whole discipline scientific is that the people working there are trying to identify what or who the intelligent designer is that's responsible for all these characteristics we see in the universe. And just like with forensics, there's a small group of astrophysicists who are saying there's no intelligent design at all. And this is where they come up with this multiverse idea, that there's an infinite number of universes, and ours, by pure chance, has these wonderfully designed characteristics that make us possible. But much more popular is the explanation that, no, there's an intelligent designer that's behind it, a designer that transcends space, time, matter, and energy. Now, this is deeply theological, but notice that the scientific community has not stepped in and said this isn't science. Notice, too, that the courts have not stepped in. No judge or justice has ever stepped in and said, this is illegitimate, we can't have this happening. Now, this did happen in the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Empire was, quote, evil, at that time, there was government regulations that the physicists were not allowed to talk in public about the Big Bang. They were not allowed to talk in public about the anthropic principle. Why? Because it pointed too directly to God. They said, you can talk about it amongst yourselves, as long as there's no students present, and as long as the public is not able to hear it. But, you know, they were not allowed to give any lectures on the anthropic principle or the Big Bang explanation of the universe. But we don't live in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union is a nation that did have a church-state law where the only legal religion was a religion of atheistic materialism, and so any scientific explanation that threatened that was declared illegal. But in the United States, it's always been permissible to talk about the anthropic principle and do research on it. The anthropic principle in equality is an interesting new development where astronomers have noted that it takes an enormous amount of time to design the universe in terms of looking at an intelligent designer so that human beings can live in this universe. That it literally can't be done, given the laws of physics that the designer chose, in anything less than 13.7 billion years. And yet the window of time in which human civilization can foster has been shown to be less than 41,000 years wide. And this was referred to as the anthropic principle inequality. And it's caused the researchers to actually whittle down the identification of this intelligent designer much closer to the God of the Bible, because they said, for a creator to invest that much time and that much resources, 100 billion trillion stars, for something that can't last longer than 41,000 years, means that that creator must have a very high value on the human species and a very high purpose for the human species. Now, again, that's deeply theological, and yet this is being published in the scientific literature. It's being taught in public education arenas, and the reason for it is that here's a case where they're actually making an attempt to identify the intelligent designer. Yes. Where did the 41,000 years come from? Well, this was first proposed in 1983 by the British cosmologist Brandon Carter. And his back-of-the-envelope calculation showed that humans, or a species like humans, in other words, intelligent and capable of launching civilization, could not survive for longer than a million years. And then it was Frank Tipler and John Barrow who wrote a book in 1986 called The Cosmological Anthropic Principle. And they said, if we're talking human civilization or some intelligent alien species that has launched civilization, they calculated that that civilization could last for no more than 41,000 years. And it's based on the fact that, you know, there's all these hundreds of characteristics of the universe and our galaxy and solar system that must be extraordinarily fine-tuned to make our existence possible. But a number of those factors vary with respect to time. And it's that variation with respect to time that leads to this narrow window in which we could possibly exist in a civilized state. And so Carter and Tipler and Barrow were calculating something a little different. Carter was simply saying, what's the longest window we could have where we'd have human beings existing? But he was prepared to consider a very low population of human beings with no technology and no civilization. In other words, if we lived like the chimpanzees, then we could probably survive for a million years maximum. But if we're talking humans that have towns and communication and a trade and sophisticated tools and cultural expression, then it's less than 41,000 years. By the way, our own calculations of reasons to believe demonstrate that it's probably less than 20,000, not as broad as 41,000. But the whole point is there's a factor of a million between the time minimum needed to prepare a home for us and the window in which we could exist. So we got, you know, a few thousand years to go before things. But the whole point is that it does have very significant philosophical and theological implications. Yeah. Primitive societies will outlast the more advanced societies because advanced civilization has much more fine-tuning demands. For example, for advanced civilization to be possible, you would need access to significant fuel sources. Whereas if you're at a chimpanzee level of culture, you can get by without the fuel sources. But once you start talking trade and transportation, you're going to have to start cutting down forests or start harvesting coal or oil. And that requires a certain amount of fine-tuning in the life on the planet and the longevity of life on the planet to make that possible. So that's one example. The other thing is that for civilization, you would need rather broader portions of the planet to be benign for human existence. So it wouldn't be acceptable if there was only a 100,000 square mile area where humans could exist in a civilized state. You'd need something broader than that. And that has a much more fine-tuned climatic conditions than, say, living life as chimpanzees. Okay, I saw there was a hand over here, yes. Where are we in that 41,000 years or 20,000 years? Human beings have existed in a civilized state, and that means where we're actually trading with one another, so people are beginning to specialize. They're actually building transportation systems in small villages. That's been going on for at least 10,000 years. So 10,000 years is when the archaeologists find significant evidence for humans in a civilized state. So by our numbers, we've got 10,000 years to go. So you might take that into account in your investment portfolios. Over here. People have argued that maybe civilization is headed for decline because of the way we're using resources. I mean, the LA Times today has got a major piece on oil and petroleum and coal and how we're at a point where it's probably going to be less of that. What I've argued in a book I got coming out in September is that they're all alternatives. There are alternatives to coal, oil, and natural gas for fueling high-tech civilization. However, you're going to need that to launch those alternatives. Personally, I can't think of any way. Oh, we took too long here. I'm back into the screensaver. Okay. I can't see us going to, say, nuclear energy or hydrogen fusion or sophisticated, solar energy capture unless you use coal, oil, and natural gas to launch that kind of technology. So in that sense, we've got a limited period of time before we run out of those fossil fuels to get the alternatives launched. But there's no hope for launching alternatives if you don't have the petroleum to start with. And so in that sense, that requires a lot of fine-tuning. That means you need a Cambrian explosion of life at a certain number of hundreds of millions of years before you bring human beings on the scene. And so this enormously increases the fine-tuning you need for civilization. You know, it's a piece we wrote some time ago, how we're at the ideal petroleum moment. If God created us any later, the petroleum would be degraded to natural gas. If he created us any earlier, the Cambrian explosion creatures wouldn't have adequate time to be converted into petroleum. And the same thing is true for the geologic features that store the petroleum. It takes time for those to form. If you wait too long, they crack and leak. So in that sense, I would argue it's not an accident that we were created 543 million years after the Cambrian explosion. That's when you get the maximum fossil fuels to harvest for launching your civilization. Okay, let's identify some factors that make for the success of intelligent design scientific disciplines. And by the way, this list I gave you here is not complete. I could name for you several other scientific disciplines where intelligent design is thoroughly accepted as the explanation. But what makes for the success of these intelligent design scientific disciplines is, number one, the designer is identified. And so I would say one of the big problems with the intelligent design movement is their refusal to identify the intelligent designer. That's what cripples them from developing a model. And that's probably the number one reason why they're not able to go into the scientific community with their explanation. Number two, models must be detailed. I see within the intelligent design movements the beginnings of trying to come up with a model, but they're extremely vague and they don't take positions that are necessary in order to come up with a detailed explanation. Models need to be continually refined, and it's based on the recognition no human being has got a complete explanation for any phenomenon within the record of nature. And recognizing that, having that humble response, we realize there's always a need to improve your explanation. So that's one thing scientists look for within the Christian community, is an explanation coming from the Christian community undergoing ongoing refinement. Is the model getting better and better in its ability to explain the record of nature? And are the models testable or falsifiable? Again, if we go back here, in every single case, the intelligent design explanation is being offered, can be put to the test, it can be proven incorrect if certain discoveries are made, and the predictions based on the explanation, the intelligent design explanation, proved to be correct. Again, you see that in these CSI television shows. They come up with what they think is the culprit for the murder of the body, and then they make certain predictions of what additional evidence they should find, and they go out and they find that evidence, and that's what convicts the person, and he goes to jail. Now, what we're arguing at Reasons to Believe is not that the intelligent design tent should be replaced. I mean, just to give you a review here, about 10 years ago, Phil Johnson, who's been referred to as the father of the intelligent design movement, came up with a strategy. What he said in his books is that the evolutionary community is so strong and so well united that the only way we're going to knock it down is for all of us who disagree with the atheistic explanation need to unite and get under this big tent. And we'll put aside all of our differences, and in putting aside all of our differences, we can unite together to overthrow the enemy of evolutionism and Darwinism. And once Darwinism has been defeated, at that point, we can start getting into the different creation explanations that would replace that Darwinian picture. However, what that means is that if you put aside all of your differences, And by the way, they really do mean that. They have under the intelligent design umbrella people as diverse as young Earth creationists, old Earth creationists, theistic evolutionists. You've got people that believe that aliens were the ones that brought life here to planet Earth. So they even have atheists within the camp who are offering their explanation of how life got here. You've got Mormons. You've got people in the Mooney cult. You've got every stripe imaginable. And there's an agreement that we're not going to talk about our differences. We're going to unite together and knock down this Goliath. And once Goliath has been knocked down, then we'll try to move forward. Now, what we're suggesting at Reasons to Believe is that we need that big tent. But under the big tent, we should have many competing intelligent design models. In other words, we need to insist that all the models that are trying to explain intelligent design would be testable, falsifiable, and predictive. So we're actually arguing there should be a bigger tent. Now, we would say there's not enough players underneath the tent. Bring more players under the tent, but have them compete with one another. And the whole point here is that the heart of the Christian message is free market competition. You know, Paul addressed this when his followers said, should we pull down, should we go into the temple, the pagan temples, and pull down the idols that are in the pagan temples? And he said, no, don't do that. Christianity thrives best when there's free market competition. And you see that all over the world. You go into the Islamic world, it's against the law to be anything else than a Muslim. Or if you're a Muslim, you're not allowed to convert to another faith. Likewise, we see that in Hinduism. Christianity is the only religion that's really been willing to be tolerant of other people's beliefs. And again, it's based on the principle that Jesus Christ is a gentleman. He doesn't force his offer of salvation upon anyone. He makes the offer and waits for the individual to say whether or not he wants that pathway to salvation. So free market competition. And this is what the scientific community practices. When they come up with their explanations, they have all these different models that compete with one another under a free market system. And that's one of their big complaints about Christians. They say, where is your free market competition? And if you expect us to listen to you, we need to see you modeling the kinds of things you're asking us to model. And so they're waiting for us as Christians to demonstrate that free market competition. And free market competition should be based on aggressively developing short-range predictions. Again, I hear that complaint. Sometimes there's a vague prediction coming out of the intelligent design movement that has no hope of being fulfilled for another 300 or 400 years. They say, no. We want something that's going to happen within 2 or 3 years, not 200 or 300 years. But particularly, they're asking us to vigorously reject the failed models. That's what happens in the scientific community. Someone comes up with an explanation, and all of the predictions fail to come true, and they say, well, that's a model we can get rid of. And by the way, that's considered to be progress in the scientific community. The scientific community encourages people to develop really weird or wild models, and constantly have to remind people that a lot of the scientific literature is devoted to that. It gives people the freedom to come up with explanations that the authors themselves believe are most likely incorrect. But by coming up with bad explanations and trying to prove why they're bad, they're able to improve and strengthen the models that are good. And likewise, non-Christians are looking for us as believers to do the same thing. Yes. Right. Right. Right, right. Yeah, it's a good example. But no, I had friends when I was doing scientific research at the University of Toronto and Caltech that devoted their entire scientific energy to proposing models that they thought were wrong. And it's based on the idea that if I can force the scientific community to come up with better reasons why this explanation is wrong, we're going to make progress in discovering what is right. Well, we need to be doing that within the Christian community. But once we prove that something is wrong, we need to get rid of it. And that's been a huge complaint of the scientific community. Why is the young Earth creationist model, for example, still on the table? And by the way, that's not the only one. There's also within the Christian community this intelligent design explanation that the Earth is the center of the solar system, geocentrism. or a sophisticated version of that where they say our Milky Way galaxy is at the center of the universe. And scientists say these are provably false models. Why are you Christians continuing to tolerate the expression of these models? Why are you promoting the books that try to promote those kinds of explanations? And when you reject failed models, that gives you an opportunity to refine the successful models. And then what we particularly need to do in this new intelligent design paradigm is challenge the non-intelligent design models with contrasting predictions. In other words, it doesn't do any good to predict the same things they predict. What you need to do is come up with predictions where you say, okay, if you don't think there's an intelligent, supernatural, superintelligent creator behind this, then this is what you would predict. But if you believe that there's a supernatural, superintelligent creator, you would predict the opposite. And hopefully it's a prediction that scientists have a good probability of proving wrong or correct within, say, 12 or 24 months. That way, within a short period of time, you'll know which model was successful and which model was not successful. And so, for example, in this book we're bringing out in September, that's what we do. We look at the theistic evolutionary explanation, the atheistic materialistic explanation, our reasons to believe creation model, and then we look at the young earth creationist model. And in most cases, I come up with 90 predictions. And in most cases, the four models predict something very different than the other three. And so this is an example of contrasting predictions. Whereas there are some explanations where you'd have the same prediction in all four models. You know, that the sun's going to come up tomorrow. Well, all four of them say that's going to happen. So that's not considered a useful prediction. So the fact that you've got predictions is not enough. They must be contrasting predictions. But really the key is identifying the intelligent designer. Now, when we've gone on the university campus, frequently we'll hear from atheist scientists who we assign to give a response to our message, and they'll say, well, science cannot prove in an absolute sense that Jesus Christ is a creator. And they're right. Science cannot prove anything in an absolute sense. And so usually what I do when I'm caught in that position is to remind the professor that he is not able to offer absolute proof that his own wife exists, or that his children exist, or for that matter that he exists. I can't offer you right now any absolute proof that I exist. We can't do that because we as human beings are limited to the space-time surface of the universe, which limits how much we can learn about the universe. We'll never learn everything there is to learn because we're part of the system. We're inside the system. Only God would know everything. Although science cannot prove anything in an absolute sense, it can establish that something is true or correct to a certain degree of probability. So that's something I told my wife, Kathy, when we got married, is that I was marrying her on the basis of simply a high probability of her existence. But, you know, we've been married now for 28 years, and that probability has gone up. There have been certain experiments I've been able to perform, and I can tell you that the probability is higher than it was when Kathy walked down the aisle towards me. Well, it's the same with identifying Jesus as the intelligent designer. What scientists can do is say the evidence points to Jesus Christ being the intelligent designer responsible for the universe and life here in the universe, plus or minus a measured uncertainty. We never have total uncertainty. But this raises two questions. Is the uncertainty getting smaller and smaller as we learn more and more? If it is, that means that our explanation is probably correct. And is the uncertainty small enough to eliminate the alternatives? And this is kind of the basis of our creation model talks in university campuses and in business firms, is to make the point that the error bar today, with the result of the scientific advance we've enjoyed these last 100 years, is now very small. And it's small enough to eliminate the major alternatives that are out there. And so when we present our creation model, we're not simply trying to establish the existence of God. We're trying to show that the God that's behind what we see in the record of nature is not the God of Hinduism. It's not the God of Buddhism. It's not the God of Mormonism. It's not the God of Islam. It can only be the God of the Bible. And so we're eliminating the major alternatives. And of course, we're eliminating agnosticism, atheism, and deism at the same token. Now, whenever we do this on a university campus, as I say, we always, Fuzz and I will go and present our creation model, and we'll invite two or three atheist science professors to give a formal response. Every time we've done this, they said, what you guys are suggesting violates what the courts of the United States have already declared. So there's this widespread misconception that the U.S. Supreme Court in particular has ruled against religious explanations of the record of nature. And this is the reason why the intelligent design movement was launched. It was launched on the mistaken belief that we can't be religious in our scientific explanations. And that's really not what happened. What happened in the four court cases, and by the way, you can see this for yourself by going online, because the records of all four of the creation science court cases are now public record. And so you'll see them up on the web, and you can read for yourself what the different witnesses said and what the judges and justices said in response. And in particular, the Supreme Court ruling of 1987. And that's the only one that went to the Supreme Court. All the others were at the state level. The first thing that the Supreme Court justices said to the creation scientists was, why are you here? You already have the right to present any explanation of the origin of the universe and life and the history of the universe and life, providing you can show that it's got secular credibility and integrity. And he says, if you've got that, there's no need for you to even come before the court. Well, that was the rub. They were not able to demonstrate that their explanation of the record of nature had any scientific credibility or integrity. And by the way, it wasn't just the witnesses of atheist scientists that damaged them, it was the witness of Christians, both scientists who are Christians and theologians and pastors who are Christians. And so what the courts really wound up doing is, I said, since we can find no scientific integrity and credibility in this creation science paradigm, we have no choice but to try it on its religious merits. No scientific merit, so we must try it on its religious merits. And when they tried it on its religious merits, they discovered that there were numerous Christian denominations that did not believe that explanation of creation that was presented by the creation scientists. And so what the justices said is, if we rule in favor of the creation science proposal, namely that whenever evolutionism is taught, that this creationism explanation must be taught equally, 50-50, they said if we rule in favor of that, we'll be favoring one Christian denomination or one segment of the Christian community's explanation of creation against the rest of the Christian community. And that would be a clear-cut violation of the First Amendment of the Constitution. The First Amendment of the Constitution forbids the federal government from setting up a state denomination. By the way, it allowed the states to do it, but said the federal government was not permitted to do it, although since then all the states have fallen in line with the federal ruling, yes. We don't have it on our website, but all you got to do is Google the different creation. It's called Equal Access. And you can come up, and by the way, the book that we've got coming out in September, it's going to show you all four court cases, and we're going to quote quite extensively from those court cases, and we give you the website addresses where you can go and see it for yourself. But yeah, if you were just simply to put in a search engine, creation science ruling, Supreme Court 1987, it'll pop right up. And you'll be able to read the proceedings for yourself. There's also been numerous books on it. And what really happened in those four court cases is the justices and judges noted that the Constitution guarantees the freedom of religion, not the freedom from religion. They basically said, if the science is good, then the religion doesn't matter, because the Supreme Court is not a Soviet thing. The Soviets said you cannot bring any explanation of God or religion in. People for the American Way, for example, people for the separation of church and state, are both aggressively trying to promote an interpretation where it be the freedom from religion, not the freedom of religion. You had your hand up, or you just, no, I just got your, all right. And it's designed to prevent a state-mandated denomination. This is particularly true when you look at the federal papers for the founding of our nation. The concern of the fathers of our nation was that we would not repeat the European error of forcing everyone to be a member of a particular denomination. And we've seen the fruits of that in Europe today. Europe is predominantly a non-Christian community, and you can blame a lot of it in the fact that people were forced to be a member of, say, the Lutheran Church or the Catholic Church or whatever. Now, The U.S. Supreme Court did legalize scientific models with scientific credibility and integrity, regardless of the theological implications. That's important. What they said to the creation scientists was, if you come in with an explanation of the record of nature that has got some acknowledged scientific credibility and integrity, it's in regardless of what the theological implications of that explanation might be. Now, proof of that would be the Big Bang model. Proof of that would be the anthropic principle. They're already in the public arena, scientific research and education arena. Why? Because it's based on good science. Now, the courts are also clear in saying we're not holding up a standard of perfection. You don't have to prove that it's got ultimate or perfect credibility and integrity. It just has to have some. And what killed the creation scientists in the Supreme Court and the state rulings was when scientists came forward and said that the creation science explanation that was being offered had a lower integrity and credibility level than the flat earth hypothesis. When the justices heard that, they said, this has no credibility or integrity. We cannot permit this. And it's based on the fact that the United States has always ruled against the flat earth interpretation. By the way, and you'll see this document in our coming book, back at the founding of our nation, at the end of the 18th century, there were significant portions of the Christian community that deeply believed that the earth was flat. But notice that the education and research community of our nation at that time did not tolerate that explanation, in spite of the fact that there were numerous people who believed that based on religious conviction. They said, because this does not have scientific integrity and credibility, it will not be tolerated. So in that sense, our nation has always discriminated against failed scientific explanations. In the back. Well, that does happen. I mean, the National Academy of Science is a closed club. The only way that you can be a member of the National Academy of Sciences is the current members elect you to be a member. And, there's, for example, there was a survey done of men and women of science. And, there's probably a few million of people. Now, these would be people with PhDs in the sciences, who are active either in education or research. And a survey was done of their religious beliefs. And it was discovered that between 40 and 45% of them believe in God and an afterlife. And when that happened, the National Academy of Sciences quickly came out with a survey of their own membership and said, our members, only 15% believe in God and an afterlife. And so they wrote a piece where they said, the higher scientists, the better scientists, know better, and they don't have as much belief in God. But what they failed to point out in that little article is that whereas men and women of science is an open club, I mean, if you have a PhD in science and if you're active currently in your career in science, then you get listed. However, the only way you're going to be a member of the National Academy of Sciences is if the current membership elects you. And you say, whereas there's millions in the men and women of science in America, the membership for the National Academy of Sciences numbers less than 1,500 total. And the people in charge there are predominantly atheists. And so who do they elect? They elect the atheists to be members. And so you've got a very distorted sample or biased sample in the National Academy of Sciences. That's a good example where the free market really isn't operating. It'd be different if membership in the National Academy of Sciences was based on merit. But it's not based on merit. It's based on whether or not the current members think that you have merit. What existing institutions? Well, the American Academy for the Advancement of Sciences is an open scientific club. I'm a member myself. Although what I've noticed in the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences is heavily dominated by the biological sciences. Over 95% of the members are in the biological or social sciences. And so it's highly underrepresented by people in the physics community, geology community, etc. But I think that's because our harder scientific disciplines have their own clubs. And so a lot of us who are physicists may not be members of the AAAS, but we are members of the American Institute of Physics. So in that sense, there's been some call within the scientific community that we need another organization besides the AAAS that would actually be better represented. But hey, the AAAS is a whole lot better than the National Academy of Sciences. And by the way, the National Academy of Sciences puts out their own journal, but it's not peer-reviewed. Well, it is peer-reviewed in the sense that the members of the Academy determine what gets published. And by the way, the only way you can get published in that journal is if a member sponsors the paper. And so if a member decides not to sponsor the paper, your paper hasn't got a hope of ever being published in the National Academy of Sciences. But the amazing thing is one of the journals we subscribe to, these atheists are publishing articles where they don't realize that what they're publishing is providing more evidence for a biblical creation model. And so you'll hear us on Creation Update frequently quoting from the National Academy of Sciences. Is there room for more organizations? I think there is. More organizations will foster more of that free market idea of what's going on. So if you've got suggestions, I'm all for it. But as far as another Christian organization, again, we got to be careful. We're going to form, say, a Christian alternative to the AAAS. Let's make sure it doesn't become a closed club. And it could be very easy for that to happen. And in fact, that's kind of what bothers me and what I see within the Christian community is that we're running into a lot of people who do not want to risk that they are wrong. And so they try to set up models and explanations where that risk doesn't exist. And hey, if your salvation is at stake, I can understand why you might want to go that way. On the other hand, if our faith is worth anything, it'll stand up to the test. Okay, let me just say a couple more things here before I take any more questions. One of the things that the Supreme Court was very clear on is that you cannot use the United States Constitution to keep good science out, nor can you use it to force bad science in. And that's why they ruled against the creation scientists. They said, you guys want to use the Constitution to force bad science into the public curriculum and scientific research. And we're not going to allow you to do that. And by the way, if you read the court proceedings, that's quite clear. The creation scientists actually were using the First Amendment to try to force their explanation in the public education arena. And so that's what the Supreme Court justices said. They said, don't complain about us using the First Amendment against you. You were the guys that brought it forward. I mean, you were the ones that said, based on this, we have the right to bring our scientific explanation in. So that's probably the most important thing to realize. The courts have made it clear. You can't use the Constitution to force bad science in, but neither can you use it to keep good science out. And we need to realize that science is a brutal competition among models, or a brutal competition among ideas. And this scientific method is thoroughly biblical, this competition, namely that we were told by the Apostle Paul, everything must be tested, hold fast to that which is good. And we need to realize that the scientific method in which all of this is being based and the courts constantly refer to actually has a biblical origin. By the way, that never came out in any of the court proceedings. And that's one reason why we've been fairly aggressive at Reasons to Believe in pointing out you want to know where the scientific method came from. It came from the pages of Scripture. And it's based on the biblical principle that we human beings have this tendency or temptation to form opinions too quickly. I mean, that's kind of the human nature. We do that in politics. We also do it in science. We form our opinions before we really know what we're talking about. And that God has given us a method of interpretation whereby we can slow things down where we do the necessary homework before we form a particular interpretation. And the entire Western culture scientific enterprise is based on this method of interpretation. And it was Galileo who said at his court trial more than 300 years ago, the greatest mistake you can make in Bible interpretation is to get the frame of reference wrong, the point of view. And that was that big debate. Does the Bible teach that the Earth is the center of the solar system or the Sun is the center of the solar system? And he made the point to the Roman Catholic prelates, you're failing to identify the point of view in which King David is talking about the Earth being immovable. And likewise, that's the first step of the scientific method. Don't even begin to try to do the experiment or make any interpretations until you've identified the point of view from which you're doing the experiment, making the observations, or reading the text. Number two, you determine what the initial conditions are. Make no attempt to interpret until you know what the starting conditions are. You know, we have to do this as science professors with our students. You kind of set up everything on an experiment table there, and the students just want to dive in and do the experiment. And we say, don't even do a thing. Don't even look at anything until you establish what the initial state is before you get busy and do the experiment. First, determine the initial conditions. And then we have them do the experiment, make the observations, or in the case of theology, you read the biblical text. But what's critical is training the investigator to simply note what happens, when it happens, where it happens, and the sequence in which it happens. I can remember my professors in our laboratory classes making the point, when you do the experiment, make no interpretation. We're giving you a notebook. All we want in that notebook is what happens, when it happens, where it happens, and the order in which it happens. We don't want you talking about the how or the why. Just note what happens. And then you want to observe what the final conditions are. And there will always be different conditions after the experiment than before the experiment. And having done these four things, you're now free to form an initial interpretation about the how of the phenomena and the why of the phenomena. Now, one of my big criticisms of evolutionary science is it does somewhat of a job in trying to identify the how, but ignores the why completely. I mean, if there is no God behind this record of life we see here on planet Earth, why would that record look the way it does from an evolutionary atheistic perspective? I mean, I don't read anything where that question is identified, or even attempted, or even identified, let alone answered. But in terms of developing a good interpretation, a good model, it's not just important to identify the how, but also the why. Then you want to test that hypothesis with further experiments and observations. And incidentally, that's one of the things that attracted me to the Christian faith. When you read the other holy books of the religions of the world, they typically have just one creation account, or maybe two. Some of them plagiarize one from the Bible. But when you pick up the Bible, you've got 23 chapter length or longer creation accounts, as those of you who've been sitting in the class here for the last couple of years have noted. We're step by step trying to get our way through those 23 creation accounts. But the value of those 23 creation accounts is it gives you repeated opportunities to put to the test your interpretation, for example, of Genesis chapter 1. How do we know we got a good interpretation? Well, we got 22 other creation accounts that allow us to put to the test that particular interpretation. And as you examine those creation texts, or in astronomy, as you do more observations, or in chemistry, where you perform more lab experiments, this allows you to revise your initial interpretation. Question? How would you test the theory that God is responsible for the origin of life? Okay, how I would do it in a sophisticated manner is, first of all, to line up a variety of gods of the different religions of the world. Then I would line up the explanation, for example, that aliens brought life here. That's an intelligent causation. It's not supernatural, but it is an intelligent causation. And then, you know, a variety of strictly atheistic interpretations. And then you'd have, say, these 10 or 12 different identifications of no intelligent designer, a particular intelligent designer, and say, based on each one, what would you expect the origin of life to look like? Now, what you see in our book, Origins of Life, is that we basically said, okay, there's a lot of different explanations, but we're going to focus on two, the atheistic explanation and the reasons to believe biblical creation model. And what we did is we started off by going through the creation accounts in the Bible and saying, what does the Bible say about the origin of life? And one of the things we identified is that the Bible tells us the origin of life happens very early. It's actually before creation day one, not after creation day one. It happens under hostile conditions. The world is formless and void. It's something that would happen quickly. It's supernatural. We would expect the first light to be complex. We'd also expect the first light to be diverse. Now, the atheistic explanation says the opposite. It says that life is all traceable back to one life form. Not many life forms, but just one life form. Last universal common ancestor is how you see it referred to in the textbooks. They'll say that first life form is orders of magnitude simpler than the simplest life on planet Earth. Our model says that it's no simpler than the simplest life we see here on planet Earth today. In fact, it's probably a little more complicated because the simplest life on planet Earth today can't survive on its own. They would say it takes place under benign conditions, that it takes place over a very long period of time, and it takes place in the context of a rich, vast primordial soup. Whereas our model would say a supernatural creator doesn't need a primordial soup. So the fact that we find that planet Earth never had a primordial soup is very telling for the atheistic explanation. I don't know of any atheistic explanation that can explain the origin of life without prebiotics. But the evidence tells us that life originated here on planet Earth without any prebiotics at all. Also, we recognize, thanks to some discoveries, that the origin of life took place in a geologic instant. We're not capable of measuring the duration over which the origin of life took place because it is so incredibly brief. Now again, every non-theistic explanation of the origin of life needs at least a billion years. What we're able to demonstrate is that at most, it's 2 or 3 million years and probably a lot less over which this origin of life takes place. So that's some examples. That's correct, and that explains why the origin of life community has abandoned planet Earth as an explanation for the origin of life and is now looking to the stars. Astrobiology. You want to know why astrobiology is getting such enormous public funding? It's because they can't explain the origin of life on planet Earth from a naturalistic perspective. Now, they don't do any better in trying to explain it from the stars either as we document in Origins of Life. That's why, as an astronomer, I decided to contribute a number of chapters to that book, just to point out that doesn't. By the way, that was acknowledged at the last two Origin of Life conferences we attended. A guy came to the microphone and said, "We've ruled out every explanation. We've ruled out the Earth. We've ruled out Mars. We've ruled out the moons of Jupiter. We've ruled out Titan. We've ruled out other planetary systems. So the only explanation that's left is that there must be aliens that sent a spaceship here to planet Earth 3.8 billion years ago and dumped life here on planet Earth. And, you know, they must have come back several times. That would also help us explain the Cambrian explosion and explain all the mass speciation events after the mass extinction events." They were seriously proposing that aliens had come here dozens of times to salt the Earth with life. Well, that's the whole problem. You can't explain where the aliens came from, and you can't explain how they could get here. Getting here would require them to violate the laws of physics. Given that it would require violating the laws of physics, that means that the alien must be supernatural, transcendent to space and time. So we were rather excited. So, you know, these atheist researchers are actually making some progress towards the right answer. Yeah, Bertrand. His question is, how do we measure the unit of uncertainty on Jesus Christ as a designer? It depends on what he's designing. And so I would give different units for different evidences for design. But the whole point is, you could say, look at the window of time in which the origin of life took place or the window of time which human beings take place and say, okay, if we're going to argue for someone other than Jesus Christ, how much would we have to change that parameter to allow for that possibility? And what is the error bar like relative to that change? That's the whole point. If the error bar is 100 times smaller than the change necessary to introduce another explanation, I would argue that that's enough to rule out that explanation. That probability would be very tiny. But yeah, the units will be different depending which piece of evidence you use. Well, tell you what, you don't even need to think about the units. What you want to think about is the ratio of the change necessary to introduce another explanation, say the god of Hinduism, relative to the measuring error. And so look at the ratio. If the ratio exceeds 100 to 1, you've ruled it out. In fact, some would argue if it exceeds 10 to 1, you've ruled it out. I mean, 10 to 1, your probability is getting less than one part in a billion. Yeah. Okay, where in the Bible can you cite the scientific method? Well, throughout the Bible, it makes the point that everything must be tested. And not just in the physical arena, but the spiritual arena. John said you must test the spirits to see where they came from. So it's physical testing as well as spiritual testing. And you're supposed to throw out that which is false. I mean, we're told to get rid of the false prophets. Hang on to that which is good, so that principle is well established. And then when you look at sequences of physical events in the Bible, whether it be referring to future events like end times prophecy or past events like the creation accounts, what you see is this pattern in the way those sequences of events are described. So, for example, if you go back to Genesis chapter 1, you notice that the text begins with a statement of the point of view or the frame of reference. For example, before we get to the 6 days, Genesis 1:2, the Spirit of God is brooding or hovering over the surface of the waters of planet Earth, which means we should be interpreting what is described in the 6 creation days from that particular point of view. By the way, most of the Bible commentaries on Genesis 1 that you can buy in your friendly neighborhood Christian bookstore have the point of view wrong. And that's the basis for the scientific community saying that the Bible is scientifically observed. I mean, if you put the frame of reference up in the heavens with God looking down on the earth, then virtually everything that you see stated in the 6 creation days would be in contradiction to the established record of nature. But if you put the point of view on the surface of the waters, you get a perfect fit. And again, it's based on what you see in Psalm 19, that God has given us 2 books. The Belgic Confession, in which the Reformation was founded, makes that point that God has given us the words of the Bible, but He's also given us the record of nature, and how the creatures in the record of nature, in particular, are words and sentences by which God communicates to us. Or Psalm 19, verse 4 puts it, the heavens declare the glory of God, verse 1, His words are written upon the heavens for all of us to read. And so the expectation there is that you're going to get concurrence between the record of nature and the words of the Bible. This is something we should look for and try. And, you know, the biblical principle, too, is that there are no contradictions. Hinduism tells us, don't worry about the contradictions, that's life. Christianity says, no, God is consistent. There are no contradictions in the record of nature. And if you see contradictions, that means you've got the interpretation wrong. Likewise, if your interpretation of one creation account, we just went through Job 38, 39, 40, 41, and 42, your interpretation of that contradicts your interpretation of Genesis 1, you've made a mistake. And so this is what this whole thing is all about. But I mean, if you look through these 7 steps, you see it beautifully portrayed in Genesis chapter 1. I mean, we start off with the frame of reference. Genesis 1:2 also gives you 4 initial conditions. Number 3 would be the 6 creation days, what happens, when, where, and how. And then you get into a statement of the final conditions at the end of Genesis 1, and then you can make an interpretation, and guess what? God has given us 22 other creation accounts. Okay. Yes. Okay, is there a concurrence between string theory and all the dimensions it applies in Jesus Christ? I'd say yes. Our book, Beyond the Cosmos, on the table there, documents how all that works out. And it actually had an impact on my coming to Christ, in the sense that long before string theory was even noted, when I went through the holy books of the religions of the world, I knew that every holy book except the Bible presented a theological system that could be comprehended and understood within the dimensions of length, width, height, and time. And we human beings are capable of visualizing all manner of phenomena within length, width, height, and time, but not beyond. And maybe I had the advantage of going through the Bible when I was taking a course in mathematics, in which our professor told us that in 4 space dimensions, you can turn a basketball inside out without making a cut, a hole, or a slit in the surface of the basketball. We were able to prove it mathematically, but none of us could visualize it. You can't visualize phenomena in dimensions beyond what you can experience. But the fact that the Bible is filled with doctrinal teachings that cannot be comprehended or understood within length, width, height, and time is a piece of evidence that its message must have come from a transcendent source, from some being or entity that's capable of visualizing beyond length, width, height, and time. So that was one piece of evidence, even before the discovery of string theory, that the Bible alone had an opportunity of being from some non-human source, from a transcendent source. String theory, which was discovered in the late 1990s, proposed back in 1980, but not proven until the late 1990s, makes the point that you cannot squeeze all the symmetries demanded by quantum mechanics and gravity into length, width, height, and time. And since both quantum mechanics and gravity are critical for life to exist, and especially advanced life, then there must be more dimensions to the universe.